And I should tell people that I have an update on that. It's something I discovered over the summer. And that's going to be the mistake that got it right, part three. And what the update shows is something I said there, based on the information I had at the time, turns out not to be correct, but it's actually confirms the conclusions even more solidly. It's actually beyond what I expected.
למען ציון לא אחשה, ולמען ירושלים לא אשקוט.
You are listening to Hebrew Voices with Nehemiah Gordon. Thank you for supporting Nehemiah's Makor Hebrew Foundation. Learn more at nehemiahswall.com.
Shalom, this is Nehemiah Gordon, and welcome to Hebrew Voices. I'm here today with Pastor A.J. Bernard. Shalom, A.J.
Shalom, Nehemiah. How are you?
I am good. I'm really excited because we're going to be talking today about what we did in 2018. Talk about the Hebrew Voices that were put out and the new support team studies that were put out. And before we get started, AJ, you know, we've done an episode in the past, actually, I think a couple episodes. We did one episode where we talked about this Hebrew text of the book of Revelation. People can find that. We did that together with T-Bone. And what was the other one we did? Remind me.
We did two episodes on the Hebrew text of the Revelation because the discussion just went so long, we had to break it apart. We also did a discussion, which turned out to be Hebrew Voices number 37, on how the New Testament uses the Old Testament.
Oh, that was one of the best ones.
It was so much fun.
So here we are. And what I wanted to do is I asked you to go over all of the episodes that I put out this year. And it was a lot. Like, I was shocked because, you know, I'm the kind of person who I look back and I say, like, you know, what did I really accomplish this year? And I look back and I'm almost overwhelmed. Just to give people some idea, we put out from Hebrew Voices, and I'm just talking brand new episodes that were not in Hebrew Voices before, 21 new episodes of Hebrew Voices and 9 new support team studies. And of course, there was some reruns that we broadcast based on, you know, events that came up. So, AJ, what was your favorite episode of Hebrew Voices this year?
It's really hard to pick. There were so many good episodes. The first episode of the year with the discovery of the 1,000 manuscripts was really exciting. But as I was going back and listening through all of the episodes to prepare for this one, my favorite episode, without a doubt, was The Jews for Guns, Hebrew Voices number 55 with Charles Heller.
Right.
Because it's such a timely topic here in the States.
Yeah. So, by the way, tell us a little bit about yourself. So you're in the States. Where do you live? So just for people.
Yes, I'm a United Methodist pastor. I pastor at Victory Chapel United Methodist in Jackson, Ohio. If you're wondering where Victory Chapel is, it is literally back in the hollow by the creek through the junkyard. It's a little tiny country church.
Is it literally through the junkyard?
Literally. And I'm using literally correctly there.
Wow.
Yes.
Okay.
You have to drive through a junkyard to get to my church.
Wow. Okay.
But our people love the Lord. We sing the Shema every Sunday morning.
Wow. Okay.
In Hebrew. Yes.
Now you go to a Sunday morning church. So this is the question people are going to have. If you're a Sunday pastor, they're going to make a whole set of assumptions about you.
Sure.
I want to just bring that up right now. So, because you were recently with me in Denver, Colorado. Guys, listen to this. There's 4 of us in Denver, Colorado. It's me and the United Methodist pastor and 2 Hebrew Roots believers. And I call them Hebrew Roots. I don't like that term. But people who believe in Yeshua and keep the Torah. And AJ says to the waitress, he says, everyone at this table eats kosher. Make sure there's no pork in anything we order. And so people have a set of assumptions about you because you're a United Methodist pastor who actually pastors a Sunday church.
Mm-hmm.
But actually you do believe in keeping the Torah, right?
I do my best to keep Torah. I keep Shabbat from sundown Friday night till sundown Saturday night. And then I go to church on Sunday mornings.
All right. So let's get back to your favorite episode, Jews with Guns. Look, let's be honest here. In the United States, Jews are known to be on the leftist side of the agenda. Sometimes liberal, but I won't use that term of someone who doesn't believe in freedom. So often it's just straight up leftist. And many of them are against guns, but also there's Jews who are on the conservative side of the agenda. So, you know, for example, Ben Shapiro and Mark Levin and Dennis Prager, right? So you have Jews on both sides. And it turns out one of the foremost organizations for defending the rights of people to have, and this isn't a political issue. To me, this is a human rights issue. Defending people's right to defend themselves with firearms is this organization, the Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership? And I got to speak to their, you know, one of the representatives who represents that organization, a guy in Arizona, who's also originally from Chicago, who's a refugee from Chicago because of the firearm laws that went into effect there. So he's literally a refugee because of this issue. And it was really, I decided I wanted to do this for a very long time, this episode, but you know, there had been the shooting, and I said, okay, I've been putting this off for so long. Let's talk about this. Let's have this discussion out on the table, because to me, this is a human rights issue. There are people around the world who are being slaughtered and massacred and the victims of genocide. The first thing the Nazis did, you know, in order to exterminate the Jews is they collected their guns. How did they know where the guns were? They had a firearm registry. That firearm registry was not set up by the Nazis. It was set up by a truly liberal government, the Weimar Republic, right? And no one at the time that this registry went into effect ever thought the Nazis would get to power. It was the last thing anybody thought. So why not tell the government you have a gun? What do you have to hide? Until Hitler got to power, and that was the guidebook for where to raid and where to take the guns away, and then the people couldn't defend themselves. Anyway, so what was your favorite thing about that episode? Why is that important to you?
Because, well, primarily because you had a long theme running through this year, sort of a sub-theme, I guess, of the Holocaust and being able to deal with the horrors that the Jewish people suffered. And then here's Mr. Heller giving examples of how guns are used defensively. He says, you know, something like, what was it, 1,000 rapes and 500 murders or something like that.
Higher than that, guys. Go listen to the episode, Jews for Guns. The statistics, and these are U.S. government statistics, are incredible. I mean, they're shocking of how many violent crimes are prevented because a gun was involved and the person was able to defend themselves.
Bad guys are scared away just when the victim shows the gun and proves to the bad guy that the victim isn't the victim after all. And Mr. Heller sort of extrapolates this, and he says that, you know, the Jews in Europe had their weapons taken away, and that made them easy prey.
Yep.
One of the things that I absolutely love about modern day Israel is the military cemetery right there in Jerusalem, which shows that the Jews can and will defend themselves. Like, Jerusalem is Jerusalem. The whole state of Israel is the hope of the Jewish people. And I just get really excited about that.
Amen. All right, let's go on to the next episode. Actually, I want to talk about some of the support team studies. The support team studies are studies I put out as sort of a thank you to people who support my ministry. Guys, there's over 200 hours of video and audio on my website for anybody who wants to access it. But for those who support the ministry, I put out these sort of extra studies a little bit more in depth. I did an episode called The Mistake That Got It Right. And part one of that came out in the previous year, part two this year. AJ, can you tell us something a little bit about that episode and what your thoughts were about that?
Yeah, The Mistake That Got It Right is really one of my favorite support team studies, because you talk about how the vowels, which are so very rare in the name, in the Tetragrammaton, their occurrence in the manuscripts is so very rare, but that they're put in mistakenly by the scribes, and how once the name is written, it cannot be erased.
Right.
And I was really excited by that, that once the name is put down on the page, it can't be erased. There are places where they would cut it out sometimes, but sometimes they would just leave it in. Even with these manuscripts that are very heavily edited and reviewed by the scribes that recorded them or wrote them down, when they would find the name, they couldn't take it out. And so we know for a fact that even if they didn't want it to be there, their mistake gets it right.
Well, and I should tell people that I have an update on that. It's something I discovered over the summer. And that's going to be The Mistake That Got It Right, part three. And what the update shows is something I said there, based on the information I had at the time, turns out not to be correct. But it actually confirms the conclusions even more solidly. It's actually beyond what I expected. But that's going to have to wait for the future. I did an episode called Pesach, Feast of Protection. And I talked about, in this support team study, the actual meaning of the word that we translate as Passover. And what was interesting is I have this really good friend who is a Southern Baptist Torah-keeping church planter. And I met with him sometime this year, and we had dinner. And he said, you know, my favorite episode you did was that Pesach Feast of Protection, because I know you were talking about Yeshua. And I said, what? And I didn't even know what the connection was, and he was making these connections that show. I mean, I'm going to have him on one time because that was pretty cool. I was just talking about Hebrew linguistics and really powerful stuff there. I did an episode, Cutting Through the Confusion with the Show Me State, with Keith Johnson. One of my favorite episodes I did was the Great I Am Reveal. That was actually a presentation I gave down in Houston, Texas, and shared there what was obvious to me. But after I was discussing it with people, realized, okay, there's some things in Hebrew that aren't so obvious. And in this particular case, it is the meaning of the name Yehovah. You know, we talk a lot about the pronunciation. And I thought, why would I do a teaching on the meaning? It's just so obvious. But the meaning also points to some of the information about the pronunciation, which is so obvious to me, I didn't bother sharing it. But now I did. In The Great I Am Revealed, I did an episode called Original Sin and the Tree of Life. Very important topic. And I want to read a quote from one of the people who listened to that episode. Layla wrote, "This is the first time I've heard about resurrection strictly from the Tanakh. I only knew it from the Brit Chadashah. I love it. Guys, without you, we could not do this. So look, you did this together with us. You supported what I'm doing. It allowed me to hire editors, to hire producers, to be able to do this, to put this information out, to go and buy the manuscripts. This year, we actually purchased a manuscript, which I'm going to save that for a little bit later. But it was a manuscript that I've wanted to see for a long time, and I was only able to access it in black and white photos. And when I was able to see the color photos, I was able to read parts I couldn't see, and it cost quite a bit of money. You know, so some of these things are just online for free. Other things, you have to contact the library, get special permission, order, you know, digital photographs. And this one particular set of manuscripts cost $2,500, you know, for one set of manuscripts, right? Wow. That's just how it is. And that's New Testament manuscripts.
New Testament? You can't drop that bomb on us and then let it go?
Three manuscripts of the New Testament that were bound up together. And they were brought from India. They were found in a synagogue of Jews in India, indigenous Jews that have been there for 2,000 years. How they got there, nobody knows. And I heard about these. And I'd actually seen the black and white photos, but some of them are really hard to read. And in color, you could actually make out things you can't see in black and white. So I got these and have been studying them. And look, are they translated from European languages or the Hebrew originals? I mean, the likelihood is they are translated from European languages. But how did they get into a synagogue of Jews in India? I mean, that's incredible. And what were you doing with these books? I mean, there's some questions here we don't know the answer to. And maybe some of these are Hebrew originals. Nobody knows, right? Because nobody's read these. Nobody seems to care. I tried to get scholars interested in these. And you know, it's like, yeah, you know, let's just assume that that's some late translation from Greek. But even if it is a late translation from Greek, this is the Gospels and the different books of the New Testament in Hebrew. That was translated by whom? Maybe by a Jew? But I don't know, right? So I think they're worth studying at the very least. We couldn't do this without you guys. I want to be able to share this information with you, and I just can't do it if you don't support my ministry. Some other episodes I put out, one episode is called The Lying Pen of the Scribes of Jeremiah 8:8. That's a support team study that has either come out or will come out very soon. Canonization of the Tanakh is a classic study I did that answers a really important question. One of the key claims of rabbinical Jews is, well, you have to obey us because we decided which books would be in the Bible. And I actually go through the sources and see if that's the case. Were the rabbis the ones who decided which books would be in the Bible? I don't think that's supported by the evidence. Interestingly, some of the evidence comes from the New Testament itself, right? Because you can see from the New Testament that there was a set Bible that all Jews accepted. So I did an episode with the professor from Oral Roberts University named Dr. Brad Young called Reading the New Testament Through Jewish Eyes. And I got to ask you, AJ, as a Methodist who keeps Torah, what were your thoughts about that episode?
I really enjoyed this episode. There are a lot of Christians, a lot of people in the Christian community who don't understand the Jewish perspective of the New Testament. And they're really shocked when we look back into the more recent, the reformers, the, you know, folks like Martin Luther, who say very glowing, very good things, even though Luther was a great anti-Semite, who say very glowing things about the Hebrew language. He said, those who read in the Hebrew drink from the source, the Greeks...
I got to stop you. That's why one of the reasons I called my ministry Makor Hebrew Foundation. It was a book in Jeremiah, which talks about Yehovah being the source of the living waters. And then I saw Martin Luther, who started out as at least saying that he loved Jews. And it wasn't until about 10 years later that he became this anti-Semite when he saw he couldn't convert the Jews, which is a topic worth discussing in its own right. But early on in his ministry, when he made this statement about those who read the Hebrew are reading from the source. And I said, this is what I want to do. I want to share with people the source of the information in the original languages. So go on with that quote.
So those who read in the Hebrew drink from the source. Those who read in the Greek drink from drink from the stream that flows from the source.
Right, exactly.
And those who read in the Latin drink from muddy puddles downstream.
Right, or from the downstream puddle. And yeah, that's yes. I actually quote that in my book, Prayer to Our Father, that I wrote with Keith Kaufman.
Yes.
And
yes.
And this is what I want to do. I want to share with people the source. And, you know, people say, well, I don't know Hebrew. Okay, well, you do the best you can, and I'll share with you what I know, and other people will share with you what they know. And, you know, I did another episode this year called Understanding the Difficult Words of Yeshua with Dr. Blizzard, who is another pioneer in this area of looking at the Hebrew sources of Yeshua. So let's talk about these two episodes together, one with Dr. Brad Young, one with Dr. Roy Blizzard. So what were some of your impressions from that episode?
It was exciting to see a Christian like Dr. Young going through and studying these the Hebrew sources. And he was dealing with a lot of negativity, a lot of pushback from the Christian community, because the Christians have this crazy idea that they don't need to read the Old Testament, that they don't need to understand the Hebrew, that they don't need to understand the culture in which Yeshua taught. And Dr. Young brought some really incredible insights on why they did.
And it was really refreshing for me to hear this from a professor at Oral Roberts University, where I wouldn't have expected that, but that's just, you know, goes to show my expectations aren't always right, right? you know, so this other episode I did with
Dr. Blizzard, yes.
Dr. Roy Blizzard. So one of the things he told me after the recording, and Dr. Roy Blizzard is this incredible scholar who is really one of the pioneers of uncovering the Hebrew background of what Yeshua taught. So Dr. Blizzard, he told me that he would go on Christian television decades ago. Right now, it's commonplace, right? You'll hear like even mainstream Christian pastors bringing Hebrew concepts. I mean, you could hear Joel Osteen bringing Hebrew concepts and Hebrew ideas and Old Testament ideas that you maybe wouldn't have heard decades ago. But Roy Blizzard would go on Christian television, and he would say just very vanilla statements, like things that shouldn't be controversial, like, Jesus was a Jew, and if you want to understand him, you have to understand his Jewish context. And he would literally get death threats from devout Christians who would feel deeply offended that he was saying this insulting thing that Jesus was a Jew and we should understand Judaism. And now it's not controversial. It's just kind of a fact that everyone accepts. Well, maybe not everyone, but we're working on it.
One of the great insights that Dr. Blizzard shared was about Yeshua's statement about how if your eye is bright, you know, your eye is the lamp of your body. And if your eye is bright, then that light fills you. And if your eye is dark, how great is that darkness? Mm. And it's an idiom, it's a Hebraism that we don't understand in English. And Dr. Blizzard explained it by saying that when you give with a good eye, with a bright eye, with a good eye, that you give with a smile on your face, that you're happy to give, that there's light in your eyes. But when you give with a dark eye, that you give with a frown on your face, a scowl, you don't want to be involved in whatever good thing you're doing. Mm-hmm. And it really changes the whole meaning of what Yeshua was saying. I've heard pastors give really terrible explanations about this being vision related or something like that. And what it really means is doing things with a lev shalem, a whole heart.
You know, what's important for me and useful for me is I read Dr. Blizzard's book years ago, and it helped lay out for me what some of the issues are, because, you know, like, here's an example where I wouldn't even known this was a question. I would read this in the gospel and think, okay, I know exactly what he's talking about because I speak Hebrew and I come from a Hebrew culture. I wouldn't even known that Christians have a question about this. And I'm reading through his book and realizing, okay, these are some of the types of issues that I can communicate to people about. You know, because what would happen is, you know, I people would come to me and ask me these questions, and I'd realize, wow, they don't know anything about the Hebrew background of Yeshua. And even what they think they know is usually wrong, or often wrong in many instances. And, you know, often what I would encounter is people would talk to me about what they thought was ancient Judaism. And really, these were medieval practices, sometimes modern practices. And they were reading this back into the gospel, something that's done today in the 20th at the time, and now 21st century. And that actually brings us to another episode that I did, a two-parter that I did with Professor Shia Cohen, Harvard University. So we did a two-part episode, the first Christian Passover and an early Christian Passover. In the first Christian Passover, we talked about whether Yeshua's Last Supper was a Passover Seder. And really that goes to the question, is there such a thing as a Passover Seder in the first century, right? Today there is, obviously, but was there in the first century? And the other issue we talked about was, in an early Christian Passover, was Melito of Sardis, who was an early Christian in the late second century, who has this text, which has been interpreted as a Passover Seder by some scholars, and it was worth looking at. So talk to us a little bit about those two episodes. What were your thoughts on those?
One of the things that I really found interesting was Professor Cohen's discussion of how the Passover had evolved over time, how we had added things to it.
What was interesting about this episode is there's all kinds of things that people today in the Hebrew Roots movement will read symbolic meaning into, and these are things that go back to maybe the 13th century. Right,
like the Afikoman.
The Afikoman. So Afikoman's mentioned in the Mishnah, but the accepted scholarly opinion, which could be wrong, of course, but it seems like the accepted scholarly opinion is that Afikoman in the Mishnah just meant dessert, and it had nothing to do with this, meaning you go back to eat, right? Because Afikoman is the one who returns, Afikomenos, that you go back and you eat a little bit more after you're done with the main meal. And in the Middle Ages, this tradition developed of you hide the Afikoman and this three different matzahs, and then modern Christians and Hebrew Roots people say, oh, that's the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. I'm pretty sure that's not what it meant in the 13th century Biblical Judaism, but it's possible that there were Jews who believed in Yeshua and had this practice. It's possible. But in any event, as far as we know, it doesn't go back that far. So we take these things for granted today. And this is, what it's worth looking at is, okay, let's figure out what existed in ancient times and what was the development over time. I did an episode called The Historical Pronunciation of Vav, which is all about that, essentially. You mentioned there was a theme throughout the year about the Holocaust, and I thought that was a little bit interesting when you said that, because it wasn't an intended theme. I think it's just part of being Jewish, is that this is a theme that's ever present in life, right? I mean, you might say it's 70 years ago, get over it. Well, I can't get over it. My ancestors were rounded up and shot and pushed into ovens, or my cousins and relatives. And one of the things I found out this year was actual people who I can know who their names were. And there was one particular family member I found out that she was murdered on a specific date at a specific place by the Nazis. And I asked my mother about that. And she said, yeah, we never knew what happened to her. We just assumed she'd been killed and I found in a book written in shortly after the war that documented this event and mentioned her and her husband by name. So this is just part of the Jewish experience, right? I remember I was in Cambodia about 5 years ago, and Cambodia went through a similar experience where 1 in 4 people were murdered by the communists, by the Khmer Rouge. And, they tried to turn it into a Maoist utopia, and that Maoist utopia killed 1 in 4 people, right? That was their utopia. And, you want to make everyone equal, have an equality of outcome. Equality of outcome means killing people, apparently, fortunately. And it was incredible to me because I'd walk around and talk to people and they just seemed so normal. And yet many of these people, most people I interacted with, either they or their parents had been in what was known as the killing fields, which went on for 4 years, these killing fields. And it struck me, wow, this is what it must have been like being in Israel in like the 1960s and 70s, or talking to any American Jew in the 1960s and 70s, because it's 30, 40 years later, and we're acting like everything's normal. It's not normal. This is not normal that you have a population where you have a large percentage of that population that survived genocide. And they saw horrific things that we can't even imagine. And when we describe them, you still can't fully comprehend it. So this is just part of Jewish life. I did an episode called Nothing is Forgotten with this, actually a fiction writer, but a person who writes historical fiction. It was fascinating because all of his historical fiction is based on actual events. And so we got to talk about some of those events and the Holocaust and the Soviet Union. And I did a support team study, and I'm going to get Deb on the line to talk about her thoughts about that, because she told me that was her favorite episode, the support team study. Another episode I did, which is really different than anything I normally do, and sometimes I do these unusual episodes, like I did the episode with the aliens, who are the UFO religion, and I did this episode with this Sikh, guy who wrote to me, and it turned out he follows the podcast, a person of the Sikh religion, and he'd been visiting Jerusalem and wanted to meet with me, and I met with him, and I'm like, okay, we've got to share your story, because what are you, a Sikh, doing in Jerusalem? And I'm talking about Sikh, like the guys who wear the turbans, right? People think the guys who wear the turbans are Muslims. They're not. They're the Sikh religion. AJ, what were your thoughts about seeking God in Jerusalem?
I really enjoyed that. And I identified with it quite a bit because I'm also a foreigner. I'm not Jewish. But Sitari Singh, the guest on that show, said, we don't believe in religions. We believe that all people are the children of God.
Wow.
Amen. Absolutely. We're all made in his image. So Mr. Singh said he prayed at the Kotel. And
a Sikh praying at the Kotel.
Right? Isn't that awesome?
That's pretty cool.
When I was in Jerusalem, and I was blessed with a trip to Jerusalem early this year, I also went to the Kotel, and I was there for about 45 minutes. I was obviously not Jewish, right? Nobody would look at me and think that I was Jewish, but I wasn't even wearing a kippah. I was wearing an American ball cap, a green ball cap with an American flag on the front. And as long as my head was covered, everybody was fine. But nobody even looked at me. Nobody wondered why I was there. Nobody suggested that I didn't have a right to pray here. And I really identified with Mr. Singh in that while I was at the Kotel, I was also welcome there.
It's a very welcome place, and you compare that to what Mr. Singh compared it to, which was the Temple Mount.
Yeah.
He was afraid to go as a Sikh. He's not Jewish. He's not Christian. He's a Sikh, an American citizen Sikh, and the Muslims hate Sikhs. And he had people harassing him in Jerusalem, not Jews. The Jews... And I was with him. I walked down the train tracks in Baca with him. And a lot of the kids stopped me and said, is he a soldier? Because there are a lot of Sikhs who are very prominent in the Indian military. And Israel is definitely a country that respects military, you know, especially officers. So they're like, is he some kind of general? I'm like, no, he's a train operator from New York. Okay, I did an episode called When is the Shemitah? Which some people think is controversial. I don't think it was. I did a follow-up episode, which probably will be controversial. And that's an episode I did with Joe Dumond, who's a man of the Hebrew Roots Movement. And guys, when I use the Hebrew Roots Movement, I mean it by my definition, anybody who believes in Yeshua and keeps the Torah. Most people in the Hebrew Roots Movement would not consider themselves Hebrew Roots, including you, AJ. I did an episode, we got to talk about Hebrew Gospels from the Vatican Junk Box, which in a way,
there we go. Yes.
In a way, AJ, that was a follow-up to the episode that I had done with you and T-Bone, which was talking about the manuscript of Revelation. We did two episodes about that. So talk to me about your this was actually a program I did with Michael Rood, which we then rebroadcast at Hebrew Voices. Talk to me about this series I did about these documents from the Vatican Junk Box.
Yeah, the tragic event is that the Christians raided these synagogues. They did these horrible things throughout Christian history to the Jewish people. They would go in and they would take their documents. They would burn a lot of them. They would take some of them as almost even war booty or spoils of conquest or something. And it breaks my heart to say this because you know I identify with the Christian tradition, but in doing all of this, these pieces got preserved. And the Christians who didn't know what they were just tossed them in a box in the Vatican and said, we'll deal with these in a few hundred years when we figure out what they're about. Right.
Guys, please go listen to these episodes and hear what I'm actually saying. I'm not saying this is what John wrote in the first century. I say very clearly in one of the episodes and explain that these are copies. These four pages that survived are copies of an earlier manuscript. And I can demonstrate that that's the case. They have go watch the episode. I talk about that. I think there's convincing evidence that there's copies of an earlier document that probably was raided from a synagogue. Maybe these pages themselves were raided from a synagogue. And, you know, it is tragic that this happened, that the church confiscated these books. And usually they would burn them. But like you said, on occasion, they would keep parts of them and take them as war booty and display them. And particularly here in the Vatican, they had these, in their library. It was a sign of that it was, you know, had all these Jewish books and books from all over the world that the Vatican pillaged. You know, one of the places that they're finding a lot of documents these days, and all kinds of documents, Tanakh, Talmud, all kinds of documents, is they call this the Italian Geniza, but it's not just Italy. It's from these monasteries that have these old books. And when the old books would be damaged over time, they would want to reinforce the binding. Well, what do you use to reinforce the binding? You use parchment. What's a good source of parchment? Jewish books that were burning. To remove a few pages from the books, cut out in the shape you need for your book, and you put that into the binding to reinforce the binding. And so now they're disassembling these books in the 21st century, and we can finally see these books that have been bound inside of Christian books in Latin mostly, and other languages, and see them now for the first time sometimes in 1,000 years. Now, we haven't found New Testament fragments like that yet. That would be really cool if we did, and someone should be on the lookout for that. But we found fragments of the Tanakh. We found Talmud and all kinds of other books. And to the Christians, this was just raw material to be used to reinforce another book. This went on for quite a number of centuries. But because of that, there are things that would not have otherwise, well, I shouldn't say they would not have survived, because maybe they would have survived completely intact instead of just part of a page that's been cut up for reuse, right? I guess we don't know. So I did another episode. And this was an interesting one. It's called the Yellow Deli 12 Tribe Communists. This is a group of people who have communes all over the world and live in some form or another according to Torah. And I think that it's important to know that this group exists, first of all, because you're going to encounter them. And, you know, a lot of the things that are written on the internet about them and videos and things are hit pieces against them. And I don't know whether the things in those pieces are accurate or not. I wanted to hear from them, their perspective, and hear what they had to say, because there's been enough negative things said about them. And look, I don't choose to live my life as a communist because I don't think that anybody should have that kind of authority over me. I don't think you should give all that authority to government. And a lot of the accusations against them, I think, go back to this issue of authority. That if you give authority in your life over someone, then, you know, Dr. Jordan Peterson has this great discussion about this. You know, people are often saying, well, you know, communism has just never been right. If instead of Stalin, we had a benevolent dictator, and they don't say that, right? But it's what they mean. If it had been done right, then everything would have been okay. And Dr. Jordan Peterson, he points out, no, that wouldn't have worked. Eventually, someone like Stalin would have come and stabbed that benevolent dictator in the back and taken over the country. And there's nothing anybody could have done about it because you've given all this authority to the government, right? And in this case, they live within a community in which they've given a lot of authority over to essentially a volunteer government, right? Because they could leave at any time. But they're living in this commune in this context. But I wanted to hear why they're living that way, right? I mean, the accusations of whatever are out there, I want to hear what the reason they're living that way, you know, hear their perspective on it. And then, you know, you decide for yourself how to evaluate that. I know that's not right for me. I believe in freedom, not communism, but, you know, hey, to each their own. Guys, I did an episode called Jewish, Finnish, and Zionist, in which I spoke to this man in Helsinki, Finland, who is a native Jew who's been living there for generations. And he talked about what it's like to be there, about this new form of anti-Semitism that are, you know, is now a respectable form of anti-Semitism in Europe. AJ, what were your thoughts on that episode?
Just that it was tragic to hear that even, you know, 70 years after the Holocaust, that there's still anti-Semitism like that in Europe.
And it's a renewed form. It's now worse in some ways than it was in the 60s and 70s, because now it's become respectable. As long as you put the word Zionism in there, you can openly be an anti-Semite.
Yeah, and I identify as a Christian Zionist. I believe that the Jews have every right to the land of Israel, that God gave them that land, and that they will remain there forever. I've read the end of the book, and the Jews win.
Amen. In the end, Jehovah wins.
Amen.
People. Talk to me about Jewish-Christian debates in the Middle Ages. That was an episode I did with Professor Daniel Asker at Ben-Gurion University of Beersheba. And that was a really interesting episode, because when I was done with the episode, I thought, you know, is this too cerebral for people? Is this too complicated? You know, we're talking about, you know, he talks about philosophy. And what he means by philosophy isn't what you and I mean by philosophy, right? He has like a technical academic definition of it. Did you feel that was an episode everybody can get something out of?
This was an episode that was really very hard for me to listen to as a Christian who loves Israel, because he keeps describing these horrible things that the Christians were doing to the Jews. So the debates where, you know, the Jews either win the debate and get exiled or lose the debate and get forced to convert, as if their identity as Jews isn't sufficient, that they either, you know, that they're not real humans unless they are either Christian or somewhere else. And that was just really painful to listen to. I kept wanting to grab my speakers and yell, but that's not the Christian thing to do. That's not what Yeshua taught us to do. Yeshua taught us to turn the other cheek, even to the ones who strike us. He prayed from his own cross for the ones who had nailed him there. And his teaching was so powerful that Stephen, the first martyr of the church, when he was martyred in the book of Acts, also prayed, Lord, lay not this sin to their charge, right? That the Christians in these debates were taking vengeance on the Jews because the Jews are, you know, somehow Christ killers or something like that.
Well, but part of it actually, I think, you know, came out of a place of, you could call it love. In other words, you know, there's an old saying that the road to hell is paved with good intentions. You know, basically they had a carrot and stick approach. And they openly said this, right? In other words, the purpose of the church in doing this was, on the one hand, we're going to persecute the Jews, literally torture them in some occasions, slaughter them from time to time. And on the other hand, offer them to join the church. and give them reasoned arguments that they can justify to themselves of why they can be part of this church. And of course, the biggest reason is the force, right? You're being tortured. You can be exiled. You can, you know, be robbed of all of your property and made destitute. Not just you, but your family, starving to death. So part of the idea here was a carrot and stick approach of the church. But their thinking was, if we physically torture a Jew for 2 or 3 days until he's dead, and eventually on his deathbed he confesses Christ, surely that's better than than him living a daily, eternal, conscious torment in hell, which they believed in, right? In other words, they were, you know, they would break people on the rack, which means they would tie them literally to this giant wheel and take iron bars and beat them until their bones were sticking out of their flesh, until their bones were pulp, and they eventually die. You die of shock. And they thought, well, what you're going through in hell for eternity as a Jew is going to be far worse than what we're doing to you. So this is an act of love. We're actually doing the Jews a favor. And that's how they genuinely looked at it. And my takeaway from that is, guys, don't do me a favor. If you want to share with you what you have lovingly, okay, I'll hear it. Most Jews probably don't want to hear it, but I'm willing to hear it. But after that, you know what? Put it in the Father's hands. How about doing that? How about putting it in the Father's hands? The Father is the only one who converts people, not you and not me. He's the only one who can convert anybody's heart and anybody's belief and faith. And, you know, we, of course, have to make our choices as well. But the Father is the only one who can actually change men's hearts. And, you know, if you want to share information with people, I'm all about information. But, you know, please don't do Jews any favors by trying to push this down our throats, because that's not a favor.
So when I talk to Jews today, I want to find the common ground. I'm not interested in fighting with Jews. I love the Jews. I love Israel. I love the Hebrew language. And I love everything about that culture, because the way I define myself as a Christian finds its roots in Hebrew culture, in Judaism, in the Torah. I consider myself fortunate to be able to worship the God of Israel. My ancestors were Scottish and Irish. They were pagans. They would worship rocks and trees or whatever. But because of Rabbi Yeshua, I know there is a God in Israel. And I know that because there is a God in Israel, because there is one true and living God, that there is hope and forgiveness and love and peace, even for descendants of pagans like myself. So to see people use the name and reputation of Rabbi Yeshua to hurt others breaks my heart. It really, I feel deep pain over it. It makes me want to look more closely at the things that I'm doing and saying in my own ministry and in my own life and ask, am I just as guilty? Am I doing something worse? Am I perpetuating this horrible thing? Have I dealt with the plank in my own eye, since I'm already so worked up about the speck in my brother's eye?
Here's a great quote from Nachmanides, who was forced to debate with Pablo Cristiani in 1263 in Barcelona. It's the famous Barcelona disputation. They made a movie about it called The Disputation. Very interesting movie. He says, when the lion invites the mouse to a disputation, your majesty — he's saying this to King James I of Aragon, Nachmanides had explained, look, I don't want to participate in this debate. And the king said, what, are you afraid of debates? He's like, no, I've debated my whole life. This is what rabbis do. He says, when the lion invites the mouse to a disputation, your majesty, the mouse, however fond he may be of arguing, would do well to avoid the disputation if he can. For the poor mouse does not know which to fear most, losing the argument or winning it. And the point of Nachmanides is there was a power differential. That's what they would call it in modern, maybe intersectional terms. I'm sorry for using the terminology. But there's a power differential between Nachmanides and Pablo Cristiani, because Pablo Cristiani has the power of the state and the power of the Dominican friars behind him, and Nachmanides has no earthly power behind him. And so he is being forced into this disputation. And, you know, people might say, well, that's not true anymore, you know, because now Jews have full rights in the United States. But hey, look at anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism is the number one hate crime in the United States. You can look it up, guys. Far more than that other group that experiences hate crimes, but it's disproportionate, even though we don't hear about it. We hear about certain phobias, but Jews are the ones who are the subject of hate crimes in the United States. We had the recent shooting, tragic shooting in the synagogue in Pennsylvania. And so even today, you know, Jews are persecuted. Maybe not by the government, although there are plenty of governments who persecute us, you know, when I was a child, I had this experience, and maybe it's a long story. I'll just tell the short version of it. But my father told me, you know, there was a certain incident that happened. I'm sure I've told the story before. I don't want to go into the whole story, but he told me, you know, there are Jews who are persecuted today, and somebody might see what you do today, where you are in whatever country you are, and persecute a Jew in another country where they have power over them. And you have to be conscious of that constantly in how you interact with other people. And look, that is a consideration. You know, you can pretend it's not, and it's easy when you're in a position of power, when you're a majority in a country, to say, hey, we can have, why can't we just discuss these things? That's an easy position to have when you're in a position of power. But when you have Jews who are, you know, not in positions of power throughout the world, you know, the United States is different in some ways, but even the United States, there's hate crimes. You have to be constantly aware of that. So this message, I think, is a really important message. It's one of the reasons I wanted to do this episode with this professor. Also, because he had a fascinating statement that just really intrigued me, which inspired the whole thing. He had written this paper, and he wrote that Christians are incapable of defining who they are and what they are without reference to Judaism, whether it's in a positive way or a negative way. They have to do something with Judaism. They have no choice. Whereas Jews do not need to make any reference to Christianity in order to define themselves. I guess Daniel Boyarin wouldn't agree with that. But that definitely is true in my experience, especially speaking with most Jews. If you ask them, so how do you explain Jesus? They'll have never even thought of it. They'll literally have never thought of it. Whereas Christians definitely have to explain, okay, the Jewish people, who are they? What are they? How do we deal with them? They're cursed by God. They're blessed by God. They're still chosen. We're now chosen in place of them. Right? Somehow Christianity has to deal with Judaism and the Jewish people. Okay, another episode I did was did an episode about the etrog. That's the citron. Really interesting episode with a young scholar who recently got his PhD, and he wrote about one of the things he wrote about is the etrog, and it's very interesting. This is the citron. It has to do with the history of Sukkot. So if you love the Feast of Sukkot, the Festival of Sukkot, go listen to the etrog episode. Guys, we're coming to the end here. We got some other wonderful episodes. I did an episode about fake dead sea scrolls, an episode about the origins of Yahweh, Yeshua the Jewish theologian, which was part two with Professor Brad Young. Guys, you need to go listen to those episodes. Go listen to the support team studies. Some really great stuff we did this year. I was shocked at how much we had done this year. AJ, would you end this session that we've done, this conversation we've had, with a prayer?
Blessed Jehovah, we thank you for this opportunity to gather, to share your word, to study your scriptures, to fellowship, to look back on the wonderful things that Makor has done and the wonderful things that Makor is doing. Father, I ask you to continue to bless Nehemiah, to bless his ministry, and to bless those who listen to his podcasts and read his books, that your name, that the Torah would truly go forth from Jerusalem, that your name would be the light of salvation to the whole world, that all the ends of the earth would come to Jerusalem to praise your holy name, in which we do pray. Amen.
Amen. Wow, what a beautiful prayer. Thank you. All right. Shalom. I'm looking forward to what we do next year. Shalom.
Shalom.
You have been listening to Hebrew Voices with Nehemiah Gordon. Thank you for supporting Nehemiah's Makor Hebrew Foundation. Learn more at nehemiahswall.com.